The latest sensation on the world's pop charts is 800 years old. Gregorian chants performed by the Cistercian monks of Austria's Heiligenkreuz Abbey. Monks have lived, prayed, and sung at this abbey since the year 1133. Now they're using the latest technology to get their voices heard. The album is called Chant, Music for the Soul. It's just been released in the United States. Father Karl Wallner is a monk at Heiligenkreuz, and he joins us now from his record company offices in Berlin. Welcome, Father Karl.
Welcome. Yeah, it's very pleasure to talk to you.
Tell us about these chants. Can you translate some of them for us?
Yes, of course. Yeah, and those songs that we are singing, they are really prayers, and we are praying every day, starting at 5:15, in those prayers to God. And it's just our normal prayers that are on the record. Yeah, and we are very amazed that now our spirituality with this album goes out of our old monastery and seems to touch a lot of people. Otherwise, they wouldn't buy the album.
What are you praying for?
We are not praying for anything, yeah, because our praying is without any purpose. Our only purpose is to say God that He is great as creator and redeemer of man. And that's the vocation of a Christian monk, that he is chosen by God to give praise to Him because God is so wonderful.
How old are these chants?
Well, the chants are very old, yeah. The name Gregorian chant is derived from Pope Gregory the Great. He died in 604, and most of those melodies are more than 900 years old, yeah. When I entered the monastery, it was very funny, because then when we are exercising, then suddenly the cantor, the director of music, said, "Oh, that's a very modern melody," and then I asked, "What means modern?" "Oh, it's from the 13th century, that's very modern," yeah.
Do you have a favorite, Father Karl?
Yes, it's track number 3. Yeah, it's Libera Me Domine, and we are singing it when a monk dies, and we are carrying his body to church, and it's one of the most joyful songs that exists. Yeah, because we think when a monk dies, he goes to paradise. Yeah, he goes to heaven, he goes to God, and he has reached the target of his life. And for me, it's one of the most beautiful songs.
Let's listen. Father Karl, it is so beautiful and meditative, but I have to say, for someone who's used to a more 20th or 21st century aesthetic,
yeah,
they all sound kind of the same.
It sounds quite to be the same, but they are very different. Yeah, when you just have to sing it as a monk, yeah, you will see that it's very complicated. And it's really always different. Yeah, you have melodies that make you happy, and you have melodies who sound very sad too. So it might sound for someone who has not yet experienced his ears in listening to Gregorian chant, to plain chant, that it is always the same. But that's really not true. It's one of the most exciting kinds of singing to God.
How did you come to record this album?
Yeah, miracles happen, yeah, and God had his hand over us because we were chosen by Universal Music. Universal Music was looking for the most beautiful voices in the world, and I sent an application on the very last day that was possible, on the 29th of February, and I apologized. Yeah. I said, "We are a monastery in Austria, and you will not be interested in us. But the Holy Father is a big fan of our Gregorian chant because he has been here in 2007, and we are full with young vocations, and we have very beautiful voices. Just have a look to a video clip at YouTube that was put by a young brother there. And on the very next day, on the 1st of March, they were calling us from London. Yeah, and then they have chosen us.
It's so interesting that you're singing many, many hundreds of year old songs.
Yes.
But you also post videos on YouTube.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Well, Cistercian monks live with the rule of Saint Benedict, and it was written 1,500 years ago. And even then, Saint Benedict says that every monk has to have the instruments to write. Yeah? And I say, for nowadays, this means that every monk has to have a computer and has to know how to deal with the new medias.
Does it get uncomfortable a little bit, this much, I don't know, contact and
No, that's just normal. Yeah, we want that people see how beautiful it is to live very close to God. Yeah, we don't want to hide from the world. Of course, the monastery has to stay a place of peace, yeah, and a place of concentration to God.
So you're not going to go on a world tour there? You're not...
No, that's very funny, because every day about two or three calls I come in and they ask me to go for a tournée to the Cathedral of Milano, or even to sing at a dinner party of some big company or some. But we say we will never go out for any tournée, and we will never sing on a stage, because the intention of our songs is always to praise God, and this would never fit on one of the big stages of the world. So our monastery will stay the only place where people will be able to listen to us.
Father Carl, this isn't the first time Gregorian chant has hit the pop charts. A group of Benedictine monks had a hit record, also called Chant, in 1994. Have you heard that album?
Yes, of course, yeah. And this was the reason why we had big concerns, because it was the abbey of Domingo de Silos in Spain, and they had a lot of problems with dealing with the medias after this. And that's also the reason why we said already before, when nobody had any idea that it could become such a big success, we have to deal with the medias in a strict way. Yeah, I could have TV teams every day, yeah, but it's not fine, and you do not enter in a monastery to pray always in front of photographers and TV teams. Yeah, we are open for the medias, of course, because we want to give testimony to the world, but our life in the monastery will not be disturbed or even destroyed by the success of our album.
Father Karl Wallner is a Cistercian monk at the Abbey of Heiligenkreuz in Austria. Father Karl, thank you very much.
It was a big pleasure. Yeah, God bless you. Bye-bye.
We've been hearing disturbing news out of South Africa in recent weeks. News of deadly violence against immigrants and of thousands driven out of poor townships. This morning, we're going to talk of a kind of grace to be found there, music. Even on the toughest township streets, one could always hear a lively beat, a soulful song. Under apartheid, even music was segregated, and that's partly how it came to be that Deepak Ram, who was raised in one of the townships reserved for those of Indian descent, learned to play a bamboo flute known as the bansuri. Deepak Ram eventually became a master of the bansuri, and he's become known for a series of albums of North Indian classical music. His newest CD, called Steps, is a departure. He's playing classic American jazz on one of India's most traditional instruments.
It has a very special place in Indian culture, especially because of its association with Lord Krishna.
The Hindu god Krishna.
Yeah, and you know, the symbolism of the flute is that when Lord Krishna played his flute, you know, everybody that heard, including the animals and the cows, and who heard this, forgot their own individual identities and found themselves running towards the sound, which is the ultimate truth or reality.
Here, Deepak Ram's take on John Coltrane's love song, Naima. It's music the young South African could have listened to growing up. In his home, there was a mix of Bollywood, Ravi Shankar, and Ella Fitzgerald. His older brother collected jazz LPs.
I remember my brother making me my first flute from a drain pipe. You know, with a heavy steel pipe, and he, you know, found a drill, and he just arbitrarily just drilled 6 holes in a drain pipe. That was my first flute.
And may I ask, how old would you have been?
I wasn't too young. I mean, I think my drain pipe flute, I was 14.
Did you actually play that drain pipe flute?
Yeah, I did, actually. I did for a while. I did for a year and a half before I went for my first formal lesson, and I took the drain pipe flute with me to my teacher. It was fine. I mean, this sound itself was just, you know, I mean, as a kid growing up, any kind of music, I mean, even marching bands, I would, you know, get goosebumps when they, you know, when I listen to them.
Is there a tune on this new CD that we could play that to you brings together in music those influences?
Well, Madiba's Dance, which is the second tune on the album, is actually dedicated to the great President Nelson Mandela. And Madiba is a respectful name, also a name of the community or clan he comes from. So this piece, the rhythm, has the kind of groovy feel. I don't know if people have seen Nelson Mandela on television. He's one of the few presidents that dances, you know, in public appearances. And he has this kind of movement. And he has this dance where he kind of holds his hands in fists. You know, he used to be a boxer too, so I mean, it's difficult to demonstrate that on radio, but, you know, he kind of moves his arm side to side. The groove is 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, pa 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 chi pa 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 chi pa. And the rhythm of this piece. It kind of reminds me of the sound of South Africa, you know, growing up, watching, you know, small African kids play guitars that are made from oil cans and, you know, makeshift drums. And so it gives me that feeling of South Africa. So this piece, Madiba's Dance.
From the most upbeat of South African songs, Deepak Rom finds his way to the American South and the bittersweet sound of Gershwin's Summertime. It's a song he heard growing up on one of those LPs his brother collected, and it stuck with him all these years.
I mean, I didn't realize that Summertime was from a musical. And without knowing the history of the Summertime, without seeing the musical, one day I decided to listen to the words carefully. Because, you know, as a musician, for me, the melody or the combination of the notes within a melody or phrase tells a huge story. And, you know, you grab the emotions from there. And then the words for me come later. And while it's kind of a hip tune, you can play it, you know, and kind of dance to it, it has this touch of sadness in it because also of the note combination and of the lyrics. And that's so much like South Africa. I mean, it's about this woman singing to a little baby that she's looking after and how her parents are wealthy. You have nothing to worry about. You know, the cotton is high. And then you're thinking of this really hot summer in somewhere in the South and this person who's trapped into slavery, you know, sing. And it just reminded me of South Africa a lot.
Yeah. I was trying to think of a couple of lyrics. I mean, I think of the obvious one, Summertime, the living is easy.
Fish are jumping, cotton is high. And you can almost feel, you know, the humidity and, you know, don't cry, little, you know, your mama is beautiful, your daddy is rich, you know. You'll get your wings and someday you'll fly, you know. So, I mean, you can imagine this person singing this thing to a little kid, giving the kid, you know, all this, what is possible in your life. But at the same time, the person that's singing it, and this is my life, and it's never going to get better than this.
Deepak Rom, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rani. Thank you so much.
Deepak Ram is a master of the Indian bamboo flute known as the bansuri. On his new CD called Steps, you can hear him playing jazz on this most traditional of Indian instruments. And you can hear Deepak Ram playing both Summertime and Naima in the music section at npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Now we're going to take a listen to one of the most critically acclaimed and commercially successful albums of the summer. It comes from New Orleans rapper Lil Wayne. His CD is called The Carter 3. Our music critic Robert Christgau says the album is successful not only because of the music, but because of the marketing.
The Carter 3's first week sales, which were easily pop's strongest since Graduation by Kanye West last September, were spurred by a daring marketing strategy that doubled as a cocky musical challenge. In the 2.5 years between major label releases, Lil Wayne whetted his fans' appetites by giving away more songs than anyone can count. Most hip-hop artists nowadays prime the pump with gray market mixtape CDs that add guest tracks, skits, freestyles, and other second-drawer material to scattered previews of their next album. But Lil Wayne was so prolific on the mixtape scene that he redefined it. He seemed to record all the time, free associating verbally and vocally. Twice, he put out double CDs of his own new songs, some over famous beats, some over original music. Many of these songs were supposedly slated for the official album. Very few ended up there. A bunch of them are wilder than anything on the hit release and at least as good.
Cool. The Empire. So sick, need a doc, yes. A creature might stir like the Loch Ness. I get hotter by the top when I sizzle to death. I just tell a clock, give me a set.
That track isn't Lil Wayne at his best, although I love it. Just Lil Wayne at his most blatant. The Beatles sample with the submerged bass drum could never have been cleared for commercial release. Theoretically, this is okay, because the Carter 3 mixtape CD, where it appears, isn't for sale. Although artists and bootleggers do sell mixtapes under the counter, at brick-and-mortar holes in the wall, and online. I own about half a dozen Lil Wayne mixtapes, and there are many more out there. My favorite is called A Drought 3. But here's another track from my Carter 3 mixtape that's not on the new Carter 3 album. It's a dreamy, scary song about getting high. I feel like dying. And if my dealer don't have no more than... Lil Wayne was born Dwayne Carter. At 25, he's been rapping professionally since he was 11. The Carter 3 is Lil Wayne's 6th official solo album. On his mixtapes, he's evolved out of conventional bling thug rhetoric into something much looser and more playful, treating gangster rap's antisocial themes primarily as an arena for wordplay. That tendency is all over the official album as well. Throwing the buck in the latest drop. I got stopped by a lady cop. She got me thinking I could date a cop. Cause her uniform pants were so tight. She read me my rights. She put me in a car. She cut off all the lights. She said I had the right to remain silent. Now I gotta holler. Sounding like a siren. Talking about. The chuckles, sing-songs, and timbre shifts of that brief excerpt from a song on the new album called Mrs. Officer typify Lil Wayne's shape-shifting rap technique. The range of his style is even clearer on Dr. Carter, where he dons scrubs to try and cure a fake rapper.
Your first patient is suffering from a lack of concepts, originality, his flow is weak, and he has no style. What you got for him?
Okay, let me put my gloves on and my scrubs on. Dr. Carter to the rescue. Excuse me if I'm late, but like a thief, it takes time to be this great. So just wait. Your style is a disgrace. Your rhymes are fifth place, and I'm just grace. One, uno, ace, and I'm trying to make your heart beat like bass. But it's sweet like cake.
It wasn't just mixtapes that built demand for the Carter 3, which also includes his first number one single, the double entendre confection, Lollipop. There's a Kanye-produced slow jam called Comfortable on the album as well. These are okay, I guess. But I prefer Lil Wayne in untrammeled mixtape mode, and there's plenty of that on the new release as well. Phone Home, based on a line about being an alien he first came up with at a mixtape session, is the perfect farewell.
We are not the same, I am a Martian, and I'm hot at this summer rain like Carl Thomas. Lock low, ready to aim at any target.
The new album from Lil Wayne is called The Carter 3. Our reviewer, Robert Crisco, is a senior critic at Blender Magazine.
I'm starving, sorry, I gotta eat all it, and I'll be back in the morning.
Phone home,
who's it?
Phone home,
who's it?
Phone home,
who's it?
Phone home,
who's it?
And if you feel like you're the best, go ahead and do the wheezy wee.
Phone home,
who's it?
Phone home,
who's it?
We are not the same, I am an alien. Like Gonzalez, young college student who didn't just flip the game like Houston. I'm used to promethazine in two cups. I'm screwed up and yang screwed up. Flow so sick.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a moment, violence, intimidation, and death in Zimbabwe. Who is behind it? A reporter reveals behind-the-scenes details of the Mugabe regime's violent campaign against his political opponents. That's in just a few minutes. But first, people celebrated the independence of the U.S. in many different ways this past weekend. Many played renditions of their favorite patriotic songs. But a few days ago, one artist created quite a stir when she combined two of her favorite patriotic songs at one event. Singer Renee Marie was asked to sing the Star Spangled Banner at the annual State of the City address in Denver. She decided to sing the melody of the Star Spangled Banner, but with the lyrics to the so-called Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing.
Sing a song full of faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of hope that the present has brought us.
Since then, Renee Marie has been questioned about her patriotism, her manners, and even her singing. She's declined almost all media requests to speak about this, but she's here with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle, for asking me.
Now, obviously, this was not spontaneous because both of these songs are actually rather difficult to sing, so you had to have rehearsed. What were you thinking? What was your thought behind combining the two songs?
Well, I felt like the Star Spangled Banner, as exciting as it is to sing, and Lift Every Voice and Sing, as wonderful as it is to sing, both have aspects of exclusivity. Seeing as how the Star Spangled Banner was written in 1814 by Francis Scott Key, who was a slaveholder and an attorney, for about 150 years, many of the sentiments of that song didn't really apply to people of color who were living in the United States, even though we still sang it with our hands over our hearts. But the reality was those sentiments didn't really apply fully to a significant proportion of the population in the United States. And then you had Lift Every Voice and Sing, which was, you know, our comfort song. But each one has a nature of exclusivity, I felt. And so as a composer and an artist, I was looking for a way to meld some of the contradictory feelings I had about my country and blend them into these songs so I could develop some type of peace within.
So why did you decide to sing... It's not your version, it's your creation,
arrangement
at this city event. In fact, you said something on your website I want to read just a little bit, where you talked about your question. You talked about this issue. You said, I loved singing both songs, but each one seemed to have their own aspects of exclusivity and segregation, not by design, but still the separation was palpable. Could I find a way to marry the two ideologies musically by melding the two songs into one harmonic thought? That would be a hell of a thing. The fear of alienating both blacks and whites by blending these two sacrosanct songs was very real, but through the door I went, not heedless of the offense that might be taken. Why did you? You obviously are indicating here that you thought there might be some offense. So why did you decide to go forward?
Well, I knew there would be. That's never stopped me before. I feel that if I let things like that stop me, I would not be true to myself. So the doors open and we have the choice every time whether to walk through it or not, as just as people in general, but especially as artists. And sometimes an opportunity is just put right in your lap. But, you know, the prospect of, oh, what's going to happen if I do this? You know, for me, I have to go through that door. I have to.
What response were you hoping for, and what response have you gotten?
I didn't have a hoped-for response. All I hoped for was that I would have the nerve to carry it through to the end. What I expected, based on my past experience, was maybe a few raised eyebrows and maybe some disgruntled folks, but I certainly did not expect this backlash that I ended up experiencing.
What is the nature of the backlash?
The most surprising thing was that of being accused of being a racist for singing those two songs, for blending those two songs, which was the last thing that was on my mind. I mean, I don't have any feelings of racism. It was an effort to kind of join the two things that I thought musically seemed diametrically opposed to each other. But to be accused of racism, the hate mail, the volume of it, and the amount of pain that was expressed by so many people was extraordinary to me, which just seemed to underscore how important it is for us to have dialogue about these very emotions and issues that the blending of those two songs brought up in our country.
That Mayor Hickenlooper is upset.
Yes.
Mayor John Hickenlooper is upset, and some people are saying that you are rude and self-centered, that you hijacked a public event for artistic purposes. What do you say to that? And are you sorry?
Am I sorry for what?
For making the decision you made.
No, I'm not sorry for singing those songs at that event. I am sorry that it caused so much trouble for the mayor, and that he and his staff, they got a lot of hate mail, etc. I wasn't the only recipient of hate mail, let me make that clear. But I'm not sorry for it because I felt like I did what I had to do as an artist. You know, some people say, well, you know, you should leave your art at home when you're asked to sing a particular song. But I don't know how to leave my art at home because my art is within me, so I can't do that. But if I had to relive it all over again, knowing how things turned out, I would do it again, Michelle.
Renee Marie joined us from KUVO in Denver, Colorado. You can find out more information about her decision to restyle the national anthem by going to the Tell Me More page at npr.org. There we will have a link to her website where she talks about her decision at length. We'll also have the lyrics to both the Star Spangled Banner and Lift Every Voice. Renee Marie, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle. I enjoyed it.
As you just heard, Renee Marie has been harshly criticized for singing the lyrics to Lift Every Voice and Sing, also known as the Negro or Black National Anthem, to the melody of the Star Spangled Banner at Denver's State of the City Address. What do you think about her decision? Does this reflect on her patriotism? Is patriotism a matter of interpretation, or does it need to be expressed in terms that are acceptable to the broader culture? We'd like to know what you think. Please go to the Tell Me More page at npr.org or call us on our comment line at 202-842-3522. Again, that number, 202-842-3522.
You think your road trips are tough? Think of what it's like for the poor touring rock band. Sweaty guys piled into a 1,000-year-old van, amps and drums weighing down the beast as it lumbers along at 2.5 miles a gallon, all to play some half-filled club in Tucson. It ain't easy out there for a rocker. Martin Atkins knows all about it. He played drums for bands like Public Image Limited, Ministry, and that's him with Nine Inch Nails. He also runs the indie record label Invisible. Now Martin Atkins literally wrote the book for aspiring bands. Advice on what to do and what not to do on the road. It's called Tour Smart. I caught up with him just before a seminar at Washington, D.C.'s Club 5. I want to paraphrase the introduction to your book. This book is part basic knowledge, part math, part poetry, part alchemy, and part understanding of your limitations. What's the biggest part?
Well, when I finished the first version of the book, I think I was all wrapped up in the idea of, well, it's going to be a textbook. It's going to be a textbook. And
you wanted to write a textbook for indie bands?
Yeah, well, I teach the business of touring at Columbia in Chicago. And so I got wrapped up in, okay, you know, geography, math, and all the poetry, the risk, all of that was missing. And so I started to add that in there. And then I realized, unusually for the owner of a record label, I realized that I might not know everything. So I called about 110 other people. And I think that got a real good balance of the bus company saying, this is what you need to watch out for with a bus. The journalist saying, well, this is what we don't like from some smart ass. Drug addicts, you know, there's a fantastic piece by one of the guys from Sheep on Drugs, who I think is an expert on drugs, talking about playing bass guitar on acid. I mean, there's also a bit by a doctor about the effect of drugs. But he's just talking about the bass guitar is made out of sponge rubber and his ears aren't working properly because of the drugs. I didn't know that about acid. He's a smart guy, so he has this great idea of looking at the drummer to get the time signature. But of course, the drummer's arms are just melting. And it's a beautiful piece about drugs. I don't think it's going to make anybody want to do drugs, but it's good information.
Let me ask you about which part is math? What is the math of touring?
In general, the demographics, the geography. I had this idea, if I draw a line from Minneapolis to Texas, how many of the largest 100 markets in the U.S. are west of that line? I think there's 17 of the top 100 markets west of that line. The other stuff that's west of that line are all of the 900-mile drives, the exploding transmissions, the exploding bass player's head because he can't deal with the 18-hour-a-day drives, the bad shows because you don't have a sound check, the lack of human interaction because you smell bad and you probably sound bad, and even if there's 50 amazingly hot girls or guys at the front of the stage, you've got to leave to drive 900 miles to be late for the next show. But if you stay east of that line, the drives are 90 miles, 110 miles. Right, so it's all of it's that stuff.
I think that's some of the most fascinating stuff that you're talking about, is this idea that bands are small businesses and that they have to be entrepreneurial. You're touring yourself now, going around telling these bands all of the things they don't tell each other, you say. And what are you telling them about how to be flexible and entrepreneurial in this environment? What are you telling them to do?
I tell bands to take responsibility for themselves. You'll be paying the price for whatever hasn't been taken care of. And what do they need to do? They need to tour. Every politician knows you have to get out there. You can't affect change from a distance. You can't affect change with a MySpace page. You know, how do you become U2? How do you sell 5 million albums? Well, one album at a time, dude. And that's what I'm telling bands. They'll say, well, you know, they want to be U2 or whatever. I tell them success really is just being able to sustain. If you can sustain, you can learn and grow and make it better and do it again.
Martin Atkins, musician, educator, author, drummer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
With that, Martin Atkins takes the floor. A bunch of young musicians gather in a semicircle, taking in every word.
MySpace? Are there 3 million bands on MySpace? Yeah. The next time I go through whatever state it is that has corn, I'm going to get out of the car and just pan around a huge, endless field of corn. Because that's what every band on MySpace is. An ear of corn, exactly the same size as a few million other ears of corn. And then I'm going to flag down a car and give my camera to somebody, and I'm going to go in the middle of the field of corn and start jumping up and down, because that's what you need to do in the middle of the field of corn. And then I'll start jumping up and down even more as the guy with my camera drives off. And then, in a fabulously viral way, I'll be the guy whose camera this guy stole. I'll be on his website
Martin Atkins at Club 5 in Washington, D.C. Next weekend, his own tour takes him to Lake in the Hills, Illinois. The book is called Tour Smart. The DVD companion hit stores Tuesday. To read Martin Atkins' 61 Strategies for a More Successful Show, go to the music section of our website. It's npr.org.
This 4th of July weekend, a lot of patriotic American music will be heard. However, one of America's greatest composers will get very little airtime, even though he wrote a piece called 4th of July. Charles Edward Ives was born in 1874. He lived until 1954, and Weekend Edition's classical music commentator Robert Greenberg joined us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco to tell us why we may want to reconsider listening to this piece over the holiday.
Ives is perhaps the first great, truly American composer, in that Ives drew from the American tradition of popular music. He drew from his classical training. He drew from his New England upbringing, a tremendous amount of experience. And despite the modernity of his music, it's one of the paradoxes of Ives, the music basically describes his upbringing in this kind of idealized, almost mythologized New England surrounding in the late 19th century. So Ives is not just the first American composer to really draw on American materials in his music, but he was such a great experimenter and, as a wealthy man, such a great supporter of other musicians that he has become an icon of, I think, what American music should be and what a benevolent patron of the arts should be as well.
You say this piece describes the 4th of July from dawn to dusk. Does it follow a particular narrative?
It does. It's program music in the 19th century sense, in that it is intended to give us a sensibility of what the 4th of July is all about from dawn to dusk. But it's a very interesting approach. It's just a 6-minute piece. It's the third movement, by the way, of a 4-movement piece called Holiday Symphonies, which is supposed to describe, according to Ives, a boy's experience, a New England boy's experience of these holidays. And Ives actually gave us quite an extensive description, which I'd be happy to read if you'd like me to.
Sure, go ahead.
It's a boy's fourth. No historical orations, no patriotic grand eloquences by grown-ups, no program in his yard. But he knows what he's celebrating better than most of the country politicians. And he goes at it his own way, with a patriotism near akin to nature than jingoism. His festivities start in the quiet of the night and grow raucous with the sun. Everybody knows what it's like. Cannon on the green, village band on Main Street, firecrackers, shanks mixed on comets, strings around big toes, church bells, lost fingers, fifes, clam chowder, a prize fight, drum corps, burnt shins, parades, in and out of step, saloons all closed, though more drunks than usual, baseball games, pistols, mobbed umpire, red, white, and blue, runaway horse, and the day ends with the skyrocket over the church steeple, just after the annual fireworks explosion sets the town hall on fire. Well, that's the program. And, of course, it's a mishmash of experiences, and that's what Ives' music is all about. It's experiential.
You described Ives' musical philosophy as transcendental. Where do we hear it in this music?
His philosophy that all things are related under the great oversoul of the universe allows him to be inclusive in his music, to stack all this unlike stuff together to create a whole 1,000 times greater than the sum of its parts. One might listen to parts of the 4th of July and say, oh my goodness, what a cacophonous chunk of noise. How could anyone do that? Others might listen to it and say, whoa, that is so fabulous. The associations are creating whole new perceptions in my ear.
So So the music that is kind of jarring to listen to in this piece, this was intentional on Ives's part.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Listen, Ives objected mightily to what he considered beauty in music. That is, he felt, and I've got another quote, and I'll just read it because it tells us where he's coming from. He wrote, "Beauty in music is too often confused with something that lets the ear lie back in an easy chair. When a new or unfamiliar work is accepted as beautiful on its first hearing, its fundamental quality is one that tends to put the mind to sleep," unquote. For Ives, beauty had to do with substance. It didn't have to do with mere prettiness. And he had zero tolerance, Leanne, for the wimps and mollycoddles who shuddered, or even worse, hissed at new music. He was famous for standing up at concerts and bellowing at just such offenders, "Stand up and take your dissonance like a man." So there's a lot of machismo in Ives's music, and there's a lot of machismo in this American culture that produced him. One of the things that makes Ives interesting and very different was that he was an amateur composer. Now, he was a man of professional ability, but he never composed for a living, and he refused to take money for his compositions when they started getting popular. He was an insurance executive, and that's how he made his career, and that's how he made a lot of money, as an insurance executive. He believed, like Thoreau believed, that the best way to proceed is not to make men buy your baskets, but rather to create a circumstance by which you didn't have to sell them. So he felt free to compose whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted, however he wanted, and never had to respond to market issues or the need simply to make money and please an audience. And so he didn't.
Music historian Robert Greenberg. He's with San Francisco Performances in the Teaching Company, which markets recorded lectures in the arts and sciences. He joined us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Thanks as always, Robert.
My great pleasure.
You can hear a complete performance of Charles Ives' 4th of July by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra at the music section of our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.